YUN interview with Per Lind, November 7th, 1990, in Stockholm, Sweden. The interviewer is Jean Krasno. This is an interview with Per Lind in Stockholm. And just to start, Mr. Lind, I understand that you were at the UN in the Secretariat beginning in 1953. And could you explain a little bit about how you first became involved in the UN and your relationship with Dag Hammarskjöld and so forth?
Well, when the news came to Stockholm that Dag Hammarskjöld had been elected or chosen by the Security Council for the Secretary General, that was quite a surprising news for everybody in this country, including the victim himself.
So Dag Hammarskjöld really was not aware of this beforehand.
He was not aware. He might have had a hunch, but I doubt it. But yeah. he was not aware of it. And the news arrived when he was having dinner with some friends in Stockholm. Came through the news agency, I think, first. And from then on, and it was funny in the way that it was the 1st of April. So. Yeah, there was a lot of jokes about this being
whether it was a joke or not.
Yeah, thing. But of course, from the moment the message had come through, then I think he felt that now it's serious business. And looking back, one has the impression that then that he was very much prepared for it. I mean, he immediately set his goals and started. But it was, and it of course, it a lot of activity started in Sweden, and press conferences. So on the 1st of April, I at that time served in the Foreign Office. I had been in Washington between 1947 and 1951 at the embassy there.
Third secretary.
I was a secretary at our Swedish legation, I suppose. Because then it became an embassy. Anyway, during those, in the late, I came 47, in the late 40s, Dag Hammarskjöld came out to Washington a couple of times for negotiations with the Americans and these matters.
Right, and what was Dag Hammarskjöld's position at that time?
He was then, he was first, I think when he first came, he was a member of the cabinet. Or rather, sorry, he became that. He was, when he first came, he was Secretary General, whatever you call it, Secretary General of in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
In Foreign Affairs. We call it Secretary of State.
Not the Minister, not the Foreign. You call Secretary of State the...
Our Foreign Minister, or Minister of Foreign Affairs.
But he was not Foreign Minister, he was the next...
Like undersecretary. Yeah, like the undersecretary.
Yes. And he had been in, before that, he'd been undersecretary in the Treasury.
In the Treasury, I see, okay.
So that took him to the negotiations up to Washington. And he was very much involved in international discussions with the OECD questions in Paris. He acted for it. And of course, it was in that way that he became international, and was entirely unknown. But those who met him on the sort of economic negotiation tables, they knew that he was capacity. That is probably the background for his name coming up in the discussion points. And I don't remember the story quite, but there, of course, the Americans are much responsible. I mean, he had Constant William and the French. It was a Frenchman who put forward his name, but I think that was more of a formality of the Americans and the British. On this OEC background, were the ones who put forward Sheldon. I can be thankful.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting. So then...
But then, on the 1st of April, I was... during that year, I served under him. I was responsible for Council of Europe affairs in the ministry. And that was his... He was the man who was in charge in the government for that. I cooperated with him. On those things. So that's why I knew him. I had met him in Washington for one of his visits. But then in Stockholm, I worked for him on Council of Europe. So that day, on the 1st of April, it's just off in the morning, he asked me to come down to his office, and he said, now this has happened, and I want you to come along to New York. And I took that as a natural thing, because I used to travel and went on missions to Strasbourg and so on. Yes, but then he added, but I also want you to stay on there and be my assistant in the Secretary, if that can be accepted by the United Nations. He was not... As also always a very careful person, so he didn't think that he could decide that yet. So he said, but if that would be agreeable to the United Nations, I would like you to stay there.
Right.
And I was taken by a complete surprise, of course. So I said, yes, all right. And my family said, I have accepted to go to New York.
Yes.
And we had then been 4.5 years in Washington, we had been 2 years in Sweden, and we were supposed to be much longer. Of course, I didn't think much of it, I just accepted it, and there it was, and the whole thing was very sort of upside down. So that was how that happened.
And so you went with him right away?
And then he went out. Oh, he was sworn in on the 10th of April. I think we went the 4th, a week before, a couple of days before. Yes, I went on his first trip to New York to take up the assignment. So my involvement with Dag Hammarskjöld's Secretary Generalship was that I was his personal assistant. During his first 3 years, we used to say sometimes that we discovered the United Nations together. he had never had any interest in the UN before.
Really?
Not at all. He was interested in the economic side.
Yes.
And the UN, he wasn't very keen on that at all. He started from absolute scratch.
Right.
Then he was asked to do this.
Yeah. So then he had to really figure out what he saw as the United Nations role.
Yes.
And then the role that he played as Secretary General.
Which he did, of course, gradually, everybody cooking, but anyway. It was neat. And it was fascinating. So that was how it began. And those 3 years, the arrangement which was made for me in the secretariat was that I was to be his personal assistant. That meant to have direct access to him in matters that he wanted me to. But in the organization, I was formally also within the, I think it was called the But I was a member of the executive office, which was the 38th floor.
Right, office. Right. Mm-hmm.
And there, my boss there was Andy Cordier, who was the, he was the executive secretary. So he was the, more or less the top man, the secretary.
Right.
And he, and I belonged to his staff, the part of his staff that had the responsibility for the General Assembly.
Oh, okay.
So I had that, that was personal assistant to the Secretary General, and I was a member of the General Assembly staff and the executive office and the court.
So then in that assignment, would you discuss with Dag Hammarskjöld the General Assembly and what was going on? And
well, the General Assembly, I mostly discussed as one member of the team there with Cordier. He was in charge of that, and he had a team, and Brian was one of them. And some others, and we had the daily meetings with Cordier, and we got our instructions from him. So that was nothing that the ST had to deal with so much. So, but what I helped the ST with the Hammarskjöld was mostly his modernism. Everything that had a Swedish connection with him, which America that had to do with. Well, he had to get an apartment, he had to get French, he had, I mean, there were things that required contacts with Sweden and things like that.
Right.
Things. But also, I helped him with all his, well, his private correspondence. He had a secretary, of course.
Yeah.
But that was a Norwegian. Who lives in Sweden, married to a Swede.
Oh.
Also, Alma, her name was then, country corner of Ham, her married name. But
What was her first name?
Åse.
Åse.
Åse, A-A-S-E. Alm.
Alm.
Which means elm.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But but she was there, and his secretary. But I was in charge of, you know, all of them. All his public appearances, I mean, all his questions, not the formal limitation, but when they, you know, ask him to come and speak, well, lots of various things to and also some diplomatic work, contact with some delegations. And that, yes, that was well, and that meant daily contacts with him, of course. But he had with almost everybody on the 38th floor.
Right.
It's a very intimate teamwork up there.
Well, in that he had not been very involved in the United Nations before that, what did he see as the role of the United Nations once he did get involved?
Well, that I think you'll have to go to the sources. I mean, that has been documented. But he was quite, he was a very pragmatic and person, idealistic at the same time. But, I mean, it was quite clear that the role of the United Nations could not exceed the role given the United Nations by the Charter, and could not exceed the role that governments were prepared to give the United Nations.
Right, it was quite clear.
I mean, he was not, I mean, he was not a fool. I mean, he didn't come and say, like, now we're going to, I'm going to work for super national authorities and things like that.
Right. Well, was he a very religious man? Was he a very religious man?
Well, was he very religious? That's a very hard question to answer. I mean, the answer is, he's given the answer himself in two ways. One, that question was asked to him, I think, in during his first year, when Ed Murrow, the broadcaster, put out the book, with contributions from various persons, which was called This I Believe.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked how much to contribute to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was asked to do so many things in the way into use, and he did that, but that, of course, later on has increased in value, because that, for him, he put in that statement, This I Believe, in mm-hmm. Ed Murray's book.
Right.
He puts down his beliefs, and that's I think, the answer to that was his religion,
mm-hmm.
and it's very clear. And then, of course, long after, after his death, you have Markings, which the book that was published after his death,
mm-hmm.
which is clearly religious, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly spiritual.
But it was a spiritual kind of.
Yeah. And that's. And that, in turn, has been discussed and interpreted in many ways. Bishops and writers and theologians have discussed this in lots of
mm-hmm.
books and politics and all that, but it's there to be judged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one should not forget this, I believe, that this is important in the context, and try to answer the question that it is religious.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not the he was not religious in the apparent sense, but he was not a churchgoer, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
He loved to go to church and watch those beautiful pictures or statues and so on, and he could go in for the music, but he didn't attend services.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was not a churchgoer. I don't think he believed in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
That was very clear,
mm-hmm.
which I think some people, well, read Markings and other things afterwards, would be surprised to.
Right, right, because many people have felt that he was a very spiritual person, mm-hmm. and even some have thought that he felt spiritually guided in some way.
Yes, well, I think he is, but not he, as he. All his markings, he said that this, that was his dialogue, that was the dialogue between himself and God. I mean, he could be guided, but that was sort of a direct guidance between him and God. It was not through any churches or priests or bishops or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever discuss any of those thoughts with you?
No, he never. No, not with me. Not with very few people.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant, of course, that when Markings was published, when we first saw Markings, before it was public,
mm-hmm.
we were surprised, because that was a kind of emotion, but the personality that. We hadn't got to know him, even close friends.
Yeah.
That maybe had been helpful, but I mean, it shows at least that he didn't discuss these things.
So there was a part of him that was very private?
Mm, very private.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And were you and your wife good friends with him? Were you friends socially?
Yes, we had, very much so. Children were there too, because he was very busy. We very often spent weekends up, but we got this concert shop in Brewster.
Oh, in Brewster, in Connecticut, New York.
In New York, of course.
Yeah, in New York.
No, we found that, and that he used for, and we spent very often spent the weekends with him, at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
But he lived in town in Manhattan, of course, and we got to rented a house in Larchmont.
Oh, in Larchmont. Mm-hmm. Yes, I know Larchmont.
Yes. So the kids went to school there.
Uh-huh.
And I commuted, which was meant to us. But yes, and my wife and darling are good friends.
Mm-hmm. Did you travel with him when when he went on specific mission?
Yes, I traveled quite a lot with them, not all the time, but quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We made an annual visit to Europe, to Geneva,
mm-hmm.
during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we and about the trip, but mainly I was on the trip to China in 1955. I was one of the members of the Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yeah. Were you involved at all in any of the issues around the Middle Eastern?
Well, the Middle East issues were always there, but they had quite broken during my time. The first crisis, of course, was the Suez Crisis in 1956, and then I was not with the UN, I was with them in Stockholm. So that was, I left in 1st of January, or end of 55, beginning of 56, I returned to the Foreign Service.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So I had 3 years. So I was he offered me to wanted me, I think, to stay on, but that was a very difficult decision for me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But my conclusion was that I had to leave. But, of course, also have family reasons, because mainly the kids, I thought. I mean, it was wonderful to be international civil servant, UN man as I was, having left the national service, but in reality, of course, in practical terms, it meant that the kids would have gone to American schools, they would have had, keep their Swedish passports, they would become U.S. citizens, but they had no international status at all. I was an international civil servant, the rest were just people living in New York. So that was the, I didn't quite, I saw some dangers in that. I mean,
yes, right.
The identity, the difficulties.
So
I decided to leave. So that's why I was not involved in that, but I was involved at this end.
At this end,
I should not talk about myself. But then I was in charge of UN affairs here.
I see. All right.
Which
so
meant that I kept on going to work for some years.
I see.
I was doing UN work. I kept in touch.
Yeah.
With him. I should go through the rest of his life.
Right. I see. But
In another capacity.
In another capacity. I see. So then, were you involved in any way in the events around the Suez Crisis?
Yes, very much so. I was very much involved in the setting up of the peace force. Sweden was one of the nations that was asked.
Yes, that contributed forces. Yeah,
we had and the Swedish government had to decide on the resolutions in the UN about setting it up, and after having that, we asked to send them.
We were
extremely much involved on this side.
Right. Now, at that time, that was the first time that the UN had sent forces in anywhere.
Oh, the first time. I mean, one had never had that kind of structure. I mean, the whole idea of this kind of forces came during the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I was very much Stone Hammerfeld and Mr. Pearson and some others.
Yes, right.
Who sort of invented the system, which then afterwards had been built upon.
Yeah. Did Hammerfeld then request the Swedish to provide forces?
And
this was something that that your country was very interested in doing?
Oh, yes, and we responded very clearly and promptly, and have ever since been very active as supporters and contributors.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fact that the fact that Hammerfeld is the Secretary General must have meant a lot to promote Swedish interest and willingness to be helpful.
Yes.
On top of our general attitude of very positive emotions.
So in light of that, were there other purposes for Sweden? And Sweden has continued to contribute to the peacekeeping forces.
Yes.
Are there other reasons why Sweden would be interested in continuing that?
Our support for the UN, yes.
General support for the UN?
Wanting to contribute to peace, yes.
And contributing to peace. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that has never been any, it's never been an issue. It's been extremely active in the support.
Mm-hmm.
Activities.
So that so you were involved in the discussions of
in
establishing the force.
Yes, totally. Yes, of course, I was, because that was my job. We had to prepare the government for all the resolutions that were taken in the UN, and to implement them by cooperation with the military and other things. I know this country.
Do you recall at all what some of the issues were around setting up the force, how it would be organized, and?
Well, all that was done in New York. The basic thing was that there is one famous UN paper which is the basis for the whole thing, trying to turn the momentum, but where Amazon and Pearson and the UN secretary, they put up the principles how they should be used, how they should be organized. And that was done in two nights or something in New York.
That was
sent to all governments in them. And that was approved here, and on that basis then we...
All right, so then you...
It's all, yes, then we did, yes.
Then you discussed it here in Stockholm.
Yes, and
And approve you.
And approve it, yes.
Yeah, it seemed.
But he was such a man of principle. They were easy. They were very clear principles, and we never had any difficulties with our participation in peacekeeping operations.
Yeah.
Except once that Jaring might mention the Lebanon crisis when we were there. So we had some difficulties there.
In what way? What were the difficulties in?
Well, the. But that was when the U.S. forces landed on the beach outside Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was the Swedish minister, foreign minister, thought that could not... When that happened, the U.N. peacekeeping force could not be there. It could be a double. Intervention,
something like that. Right.
And whereas Hammarskjöld had the idea that this was possible. And the question came up in the Security Council. There are pages and pages about that in the documents, and also in Jaring has it. You didn't touch that with Jaring.
On Lebanon?
For the one who is interested, please see one chapter about this in Jaring's memoirs.
All right.
There is a chapter about this slight conflict between Sweden's foreign minister and the secretary general, Sweden Dan Hamilton. There was once, that was something, the only time I can remember that there was any difficulty.
Right. Let me just check how much time we have left on it.